Let's turn tonight to Genesis 46. As we begin the chapter, a journey is about to be made, an extremely momentous journey, a lengthy journey, a difficult journey, and a journey that was prophesied and planned by God. And it begins in verse 1 by saying, "So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac." So he left Hebron. He came to Beersheba on the southern border of Canaan. So the significance, first of all, is that he is about to leave his comfort zone. He is in the land of Canaan that has been promised to him and his descendants, was promised to his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. And now he is about to leave it. And so this is the kind of thing that many of us can relate to when we're called on to leave something of the known for the unknown, even though there is something definitely calling us in the unknown. In this situation, it was Joseph, whom he had not seen in all these many years, and also the prospect of staying alive, the food that would be provided, the provisions for all of his family. And so he's going to begin a new life, and he comes to the very edge of the land of Canaan, to a very familiar place, Beersheba. We're going to look at the significance of Beersheba for just a moment. Does anybody remember anything about Beersheba? You've seen the words over and over again. You've gotten your biblical directions, all of the land of Canaan from Dan to Beersheba, which is saying like all of Texas from Dalhart to Brownsville. Yes, yes. A well was dug there called the Well of the Seven. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 21 for just a moment. Back to grandfather Abraham. Genesis chapter 21, beginning with verse 22. And Abraham encounters the king of the nearby Philistines, Abimelech, and Phicol, the commander of his army. It says, "At that time Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, said to Abraham, 'God is with you in all that you do.'" Now that is an interesting statement. We'll come back to it in just a moment. "God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my descendants or with my posterity, but as I have dealt kindly with you, so you will deal with me and with the land where you have sojourned." And Abraham said, "I will swear." When Abraham reproved Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servants had seized, Abimelech said, "I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, and I have not heard of it until today." So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two men made a covenant. Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock apart. And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs that you set apart?" He said, "These seven ewe lambs you will take from my hand, that this may be a witness for me that I dug this well." Therefore that place was called Beersheba, because there both of them swore an oath. Now, Beersheba essentially has two meanings, the well of the seven or the well of the oath. Then Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned many days in the land of the Philistines. So here he digs this well and sets it apart. Now the thing I want you to see that Abimelech said to him is this statement, God is with you in all that you do. Because we will see in just a moment that that theme of God being with His people becomes the theme of Beersheba. That is what God always wants to get across to His people in Beersheba. Now the interesting thing is that the statement is said by the pagan king of the Philistines. Have you ever had a rank unbeliever speak God's truth to you? Some of you may have. It's a startling experience, isn't it? I remember a friend of mine asked if I would counsel with him. He said, because I've been to a psychiatrist and he is not a believer. He's an atheist. And he says he thinks I'm under spiritual attack. Well, that psychiatrist was right. I think of the example of the builder of our home. He was a very wicked man. He was a rank pagan. And we didn't hire him. We got in on the house after he had started building it, and he sold us the house. We grew to have incredible amounts of disrespect for him. But one of the things that was interesting is that toward the end of building our home, he turned to me one day and he said, Jackson, there has never been a moment when I have not known that God was behind the building of this house. And he was absolutely right. So, God can speak through a donkey. He can speak through unbelievers. And he can speak through pagans. And that's what God was doing that day. He was expressing a truth through Abimelech when he said that which was absolutely accurate. God is with you in all that you do. Now let's fast forward years later when Abraham's son Isaac comes to Beersheba. Look at Genesis chapter 26, verse 23. From there he went up, this is Isaac, to Beersheba. This is the familiar sojourning place that he remembered as a child. It was from Beersheba that his father Abraham had been told, arise and take your son Isaac, whom you love, and go to one of the mountains of Moriah and sacrifice him. So this is the place that Isaac had left as a teenager to go out with his father Abraham to that horrifying occasion. Verse 23, from there he went up to Beersheba, and look here, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham your father. Fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now, here he is at Beersheba, receiving the promises of the Abrahamic covenant confirmed to him. I'll bless you and multiply your offspring. But there is that central promise that Abimelech had announced to Abraham God is with you. I am with you and will bless you. So now we can go back to our text tonight and see something of the significance of Beersheba. Right on the edge of his country, Jacob goes to this place. He comes to Beersheba, this familiar family location, and he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And lo and behold, look at verse 2. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night, just as he had done to Isaac at that place, and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. So the first thing he tells him is not to fear, because he has a plan. He says, For there I will make you into a great nation. It's as though a great Old Testament scholar has said the country of Egypt was the womb in which Israel was formed, and from Israel, and from which Israel came forth. So God has this plan here and tells Jacob, don't fear this trip. Don't fear going away. Don't fear the unknown, because I'm going to fulfill that promise of making the descendants a great nation. There I will make you into a great nation. And I wonder what that noise is. Yeah, I think you should check. Anyway, those of you listening by tape, it's Jackson here, and we're just checking on a noise. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt. Notice verse 4. Here is the promise of his presence again. I will be with you. That's the recurring theme of Beersheba. I myself will go down with you to Egypt. Now, God had already shown himself true to that promise, because you remember in the story of Joseph, it constantly tells us Joseph prospered because the Lord was with him, or he was thrown into the dungeon, but the Lord was with him. God was with Joseph, and God is saying, I am the God of your family, the God of your fathers, and I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. Now, he is finally telling Jacob about his provisions for him. I'll also bring you up again, and don't worry, Joseph will be with you at the time of your death. Remember that God has spoken to Jacob before. When he left his home, fleeing from Esau, and he had left Beersheba, and he had come to the place where he had the dream about the ladder on the earth and so on. You remember it says in Genesis 28, verse 13, the Lord stood above it and said, I'm the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac, the land on which you lie. I will give to you and your offspring. Your offspring will be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, and the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you. And it's the same kind of promise here in Beersheba, as he's about to leave the known for the unknown. This promise of God being with us has been called by Reformed theologians the Emmanuel promise, or the Emmanuel principle, because you remember that Emmanuel is the Hebrew for God with us. The virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son, and shall call his name Jesus. And she'll call his name Emmanuel, which being translated is God with us. And this whole idea of God being with us is very much at the heart of Jesus' incarnation ministry. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus told his disciples that there would be a Comforter given, a Holy Spirit, who would not only be with them, but be with them in the most intimate way possible. He would be in them. And then, of course, you think of the Great Commission, where Jesus says, "Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations." And he ends it by saying, "Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." And when we finally get to our final state with our glorified bodies and the holy city, New Jerusalem, comes down out of heaven to earth, and the dwelling place of God is with men on the renewed earth. It says in Revelation 21, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man." With man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. So this Beersheba promise became the Emmanuel promise, and it will finally be fulfilled for us. His provision is very important here to comfort Jacob's heart, because Jacob does have fears. He does have the dread of leaving the sure thing, Canaan, and going down to Egypt. But God is saying, "Don't fear it. I'll make you into a great nation." That's the whole purpose of this, to keep everybody alive and make them into a huge, enormous, significant nation like I promised. "I myself will go down with you to Egypt. I'll also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." What he is saying to Jacob is extremely important, because so often we need to hear it for our own lives. He is saying, "This is not a mistake. This is not a mistake. This is not plan B. This is not God's second best. This is my plan, my provision, my providence for you." So what is about to happen is that the prophecies are being fulfilled about the great nation being formed, and the fact that it will be done in a strange land. Any comments or questions about these first four stirring verses? There's also some significance, as I've told you before. You need to watch it in these chapters when Moses refers to Jacob as Israel. When he does, he is speaking of his covenant identity before God as a patriarch and the father of the nation. And so that is, I think, significant in verse 1. Israel took his journey with all that he had. This man embodies the nation. He's the recipient of the promises. His name has been changed to Israel. And in verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night. And yet he uses his familiar family name there and says, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here am I." And I don't even begin to guess why he did that. I suppose various theories could be speculated, but it seems like it's the very familiar family name that will get his attention. In any event, Jacob sets out. In verse 5, "Then Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, their little ones, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They also took their livestock and their goods, which they gained in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his offspring with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, all his offspring he brought with him to Egypt. So this is more than a temporary sojourn, isn't it? This is a migration of the entire tribe from Canaan to Egypt. And God has made it not only necessary because of the famine, but desirable because of Joseph. And it is God's purpose that there they should be for 400 years. So, they go out, and now verses 8 through 27 are fascinating verses. It speaks of the names of the descendants of Israel who came into Egypt. The text is laid out for this passage wonderfully in the New International Version. If you happen to have an NIV, or just go home tonight if you're not using it this evening, and take a look at the way all the names are laid out, and you'll be able to count the names. And scholars have spent centuries counting the names and trying to come up with solutions to what they see as difficulties in the text. I'm not going to read all the names to you, but I am going to show you some features here of these lists. The first thing that I want you to notice is verse 9, the sons of Reuben: Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. Now the interesting thing about that is that when Reuben made an offer to Jacob just a year ago about the fact that if he didn't return with Benjamin, that Jacob could kill his two sons, he only had two sons. Now he's got four. But if you think that's something, you ain't seen nothing yet. Look at verse 21. And the sons of Benjamin: Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, and I love these, Muppim, Huppim, and Ard. I think I knew a nursery rhyme name. Anyway, that was winking and blinking and nod, wasn't it? But anyway, we've got 10 kids that Benjamin has. Benjamin is 21 years old at this time. You can't do it. You just can't do it. What's going on here? It is a genealogy, but it's the same kind of principle that we've talked about in passing as we've talked about our being in Adam. The realistic view is that we were all in Adam organically and potentially when he sinned. The representative view is that he was our representative. And the realistic view is very much the position of those who look to Hebrews chapter 7, which teaches that very great truth about the primacy of Melchizedek. And in Hebrews 7, verses 9 and 10, you remember it says, in the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it's testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. And so the writer is making the point that Melchizedek holds the primacy of the priesthood because the later priest, Levi, is the lesser one. He actually paid tithes through Abraham. Well, it's the representative, it's the realistic principle here. The the solidarity of the family in the genealogies is such that as far as Moses is concerned, the future children, the future sons of Benjamin, and these future two sons of Reuben, and any other children and grandchildren that weren't born yet, are regarded as having gone to Egypt with Jacob. So, these are the names of the future Israelites, as well as the names of those who made the trip. Now, the next thing to the Reformation Study Bible has a good note about this. It says, the offspring were viewed as present in their parents. The offspring were viewed as present in their parents. Now, the next thing I want you to notice is the end of verse 15. Altogether, his sons and his daughters numbered 33. Look at verse 18. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and these she bore to Jacob, 16 persons. Look at verse 22. These are the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob, 14 persons in all. Verse 23, end of verse 25. These she bore to Jacob, 7 persons in all. So you've got a list of 33, a list of 16, a list of 14, and a list of 7. You add up 33, 16, 14, and 7, and you get 70. You've got to be careful because there's two you better not count. Look at verse 12. The sons of Judah, Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. You're tempted to count those, but it says, but and Onan died in the land of Canaan. So, watch those details. Now, what is interesting is how to explain verse 26. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came into Egypt who were his own descendants, not including Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. We've already seen that everything adds up to 70, so we know we're going to get to 70. Then it says in verse 27, and the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. And so, all the persons of the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. So the two verses look like they're saying, well, there were 66 people who came with Jacob. And then you see from verse 27 that you're supposed to add 2, Ephraim and Manasseh, sons of Joseph who were born in Egypt. And somehow you're supposed to come up with 70. But you only come up with 68. And yet, the total of all the people that have been mentioned are 70. And so scholars have just scratched their heads over those two verses. And they've come up, they've asked themselves, well, who are these extra 2 people that you have to come up with besides the 66 and Ephraim and Manasseh, who make 68. Who are the other 2 people? And one scholar thinks, well, it's and Onan, the 2 who were killed. But no, they've already been omitted from that list. And if you add up the people in that list and exclude and Onan, you still get 33. And then there are other people who think, well, it's got to be Jacob and Leah, because Rachel had died, but we don't read of Leah dying. Yeah, but Leah only adds 1 more. Jacob is included in this list. And besides, Leah really isn't mentioned at all. There are a number of alternatives, but here is what I think is the right solution. And that is, if you notice at Let's read all of verse 15. These are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Paddan Aram, together with his daughter Dinah. Altogether, his sons and his daughters, numbered 33. There's a daughter named Dinah there that you are familiar with. Then in verse 17, there is a granddaughter named Sarah. She is one of the, she's a daughter of Asher. So she's Jacob's granddaughter. So you've got two women mentioned in the passage. And they're all in on the count. If you add them together, then you get 70. However, the two women, Dinah and Sarah, were not ever intended to be heads of clans. Being women, they were not intended to be future heads of clans in the 12 tribes of Israel. So, even though they're included in the 70 number, they cannot be included among the heads of clans, so that only makes 66 plus Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh later became the two of the 12 tribes of Israel. Does anybody know how that happened or why that happened? Seems like if Ephraim and Manasseh replaced Joseph, you'd have 13 tribes of Israel. Yeah. Levi was taken out of the count and replaced by Ephraim and Manasseh, substituting for Joseph and Levi. In any event, what I'd simply want you to see is the status of the two women is not the same as the status of all the sons and grandsons, because they will be heads of clans in Egypt. So if you simply honor the fact that Dinah and Sarah are part of the count of 70, but they cannot be included among the clans, the clan chiefs, then you've got 66 plus Ephraim and Manasseh, that's 68, plus Dinah and Sarah, which is 70. Yes, brother?
I was thinking about the possibility that some of the women might have been pregnant and had their children, so they got to Egypt, so therefore they could have been counted then, but then were not. You see what I mean?
Yeah, that could be. Furthermore, I think that there may have been more who came. I think that the as we get to again to verse 27, we find a particular number mentioned here. All of the persons of the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. And Gordon Wenham, who's written an excellent commentary on Genesis, calls 70 a sacred round number. And it is. It's a number that also symbolizes a large, complete group. Moses was told by God to bring 70 of the elders up to Mount Sinai. The days of our lives are 70, according to Psalm 90. So 70 is a normal lifespan. But if by reason of strength they're 80, then they soon pass away and we fly away. So anyway, the idea here is totality. Moses has made a way for it to be very literal. It did happen. I mean, if you add all the numbers, that's 70. But still, the overarching idea is that all of Israel came, and that fulfills the promise that we started this study with back in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13. Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. All part of God's plan, all part of God's providence. They have now come to the land that is not theirs. to be sojourners. Any other comments or observations? Well,
afflicted for a while. They lived pretty good for quite a long while.
They did.
But the fact that they weren't in their own land, is that what they mean? What it means by being afflicted for 400 years? For all of the time?
That's a good question. That would be, in other words, why weren't they afflicted for just the last 40, is what you're asking.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a pretty good answer. They were estranged from their land, that they were in that situation. Look at verse 28. He had sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him in Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. This is very fitting, isn't it? Judah was the one who had originally separated Joseph from Jacob. Now he is the one who is going before them into Goshen to reunite them. He is overseeing the details of the reunion of the two family members that he had torn asunder. Now, verse 29, sometimes, especially when you have a modern translation of the Bible, you do tend to speed read a little bit. You read it like you would read a novel sometimes. And there are times when the pace ought to be slowed down. One of the things you'll find if and when you ever return to reading the King James Version, the King James Version just slows you down. It's not going to let you read zip-zip like we read our modern translations. It slows you down with complete formal equivalence, every word in the Hebrew being represented, and a grandeur of style. And verse 29 has a great grandeur about it. And there are a couple of things to notice in the verse. First of all, there's kind of a parallel in the verse, and then secondly, there's a great dynamic contrast. So let's not race through verse 29. It says, "Then Joseph prepared his chariot and went up." This is an extremely formal occasion. Joseph sees to every detail about his chariot, and then he goes up to meet, and then there's the name change. Israel, his father. What is being communicated here is that he's not just going up to meet his father. He's not just going up to meet Jacob. He is going up to meet, yes, a person he loves more than anybody else, but he's going to meet a very important personage in the sight and plan of God. Joseph is the great gee whiz in Egypt, but Jacob is Israel. And so it's interesting that there is the name change here. These are two dignitaries about to meet each other. And one may be outfitted in gold and the other one simply in a shepherd's robe with a belt around his waist. But the dignity of Jacob is conveyed in Israel, and we'll really see it next time when this old man has the nerve to bless Pharaoh. Blesses him twice. The identity of Jacob is very important. So two important people are about to meet, as well as a beloved father and son. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. And then just stop a moment and think about the next few words. He presented himself to him. What must that have been like? Jacob hasn't seen him in all these many years. Last time he saw him, he was just a kid. dreaming dreams, irritating his brothers. And now he sees him, and he's grown up, and he's got the panoply of Egypt behind him, and he has probably the Egyptian headdress. He is dressed in his role as second in command, as vizier of Egypt. He presents himself to this visiting dignitary. It is a great, grand, and momentous event. So don't read it so fast that you lose that sense of it. And then I love the next phrase, and fell on his neck and wept on his neck good while. Here is this magnificent kingly figure. Can it possibly be Joseph? And he says, Dad! And hugs him. It's one of the great moments in Scripture. A great dynamic contrast with the way Joseph prepares the chariot, goes up, presents himself, and then falls on his neck and cries a while. Verse 30. Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die." He's been talking about dying ever since Joseph was sold into Egypt. He says, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you're still alive." What New Testament character does he sound like? Simeon. "Now let your servant depart in peace." Looks at the baby Jesus, and he's ready to go. And this has satisfied the longings of Jacob's heart. So then, verse 31, Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me.'" So there has to be a formal announcement made to Pharaoh that the arrival has taken place. Pharaohs don't like to be kept in the dark. Joseph might say, "You know, I was visiting with my father and brothers the other day." And Pharaoh might say, "Well, when did they get here?" "Well, it was last week." "Well, I wasn't told." So, you know, you don't want to do things like that. So Joseph says, "I've got to go tell Pharaoh. I'm going to say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me.'" But verse 32, Joseph has a point he really wants to make. He says, "I will go up and tell..." Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they've brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have.'" Let's talk about what all Joseph is conveying in that message. This is almost politicians call signals. Yesterday, John McCain signaled to the Republican conservative base that he might be unhappy with President Bush's position on the war in Iraq. Signaled it. So he said, what are the signals to Pharaoh? They're shepherds, and what does that mean?
They're not going to become Egyptians.
Yes, they're not going to become Egyptians, and they are going to be here with their livestock. You don't have to worry about my filling the court with them. I'm not going to make Judah the attorney general. I'm not going to disrupt life in any way. They're shepherds. They've been keepers of livestock. They brought their flocks. What does that mean? They're going to stay busy. They're going to provide for their own food. They're not going to live off the state. They're not going to be leeches or parasites in any way. These are signals that Joseph is sending. They brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. Then Joseph does, after he makes sure, says this to Pharaoh so that they'll know that they're no threat to Pharaoh or to the Egyptians. In verse 33, he coaches them a little bit. He says, when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? You shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers. And this is Joseph's method in his madness. Joseph has already intended that they should live in Goshen, which is near enough yet far enough away so that they can live separately and they will be perceived as no threat to the Egyptians. They will be indigenous. They will somewhat isolated. But Pharaoh has simply told them, come to Egypt. What Joseph wants is for Pharaoh to conclude Goshen is the place for them. It needs to be Pharaoh's idea. So he's going to say, and we will see when he does go in, he says, they're now in the land of Goshen. That's Goshen, Pharaoh. G-O-S-H-E-N, Goshen. Good place for shepherds. What? That's the idea here. He wants Pharaoh to get the idea and be the one to pronounce that they're going to stay in Goshen. So he says, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even till now, both we and our fathers, in order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Egyptians wanted to keep away personally from those who dealt with livestock, both sheep and cattle. So there we are as we end tonight. What Joseph has done has been God's secondary cause to save his family and the entire nation. And God has reassured Jacob that it's safe to go. It's not only a good thing to do, it's God's thing to do. It's what God wants. It's God's plan and God's providence. And God is going to be with them on the journey. So let's go back to verse 30 in closing tonight. Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I've seen your face and know that you're still alive. We often lament people who died before they see things or know about things that we think they would have really liked or enjoyed. If a parent dies before his grandchildren are born, or someone dies before some momentous event takes place, we think that that is a tragedy, but the fact is we're all going to have unfinished business when we die. Always going to be something or someone that we haven't tended to, or some hope that hasn't come true. But one of the things that I think we are seeing in the story of Joseph is numerous instances where he's a type of Jesus. And I've pointed out before you that he has shown them the way to life. He has prepared a place for them. These are concepts that Jesus has done on a spiritual level, according to the Gospel of John. And I think that there is a type of the Lord Jesus in verse 30. Type of Jesus, type of the believer. Why did Israel think he could be happy to die? Because he knew that Joseph was.
Well.
And alive. knew that Joseph was alive. I've seen your face and know that you are still alive. And so when you and I are finally called to die, we may have regrets, and those that we leave behind may have many regrets about what we won't see, what we won't know, things that have been left undone. But we can die happy if we know the Son who is alive, the resurrection and the life, our Lord Jesus Christ. And we will end there tonight. Any prayer requests this evening? Yes, Michael.
I got an email from Bill Gaddis today. They somehow somebody got a hold.